Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, this is Jim Stein, your host for New Books in Physics. Our guest today is John Gribben, the author of Six Impossible Things, The Mystery of the Quantum World. Frankly, although there have been a number of good books on quantum mechanics, this is my favorite. The book details the central mystery of quantum mechanics and outlines several interpretations that have been proposed. I've never seen these interpretations so clearly and succinctly stated, and I'd recommend it to anyone who wants to understand how physicists have tried to come to grips with one of the universe's most perplexing mysteries. John, welcome to the show.
Welcome, indeed. I'm very flattered by this introduction. I hope I can live up to it.
I'm sure you will. John, what motivated you to write this book?
Well, it's been a long time brewing. I've been writing about quantum physics for many years, I mean, even many decades, and I get increasingly frustrated with the way some people accept these ideas as some deep truth. I mean, what they're really telling us is that we don't really understand what's going on. So they're kind of cover up for our misunderstanding and our ignorance. And that's why I would treat them as impossible things. And I regard them as what I call the quanta of solace. You know, we take solace in something we don't understand by pretending we understand it.
Why have physicists been unable to come up with common sense interpretations for a collection of equations that work beautifully to describe quantum phenomena?
Well, the mystery is why that we don't have an explanation. And the obvious answer is that it's because we're missing something. There may be a deeper truth to what's going on than anything we've discovered. And the fact that we found the equations doesn't mean that we have an understanding in a physical sense. There was a saying which started going around quite early on in this process when students started questioning their teachers about how could all this stuff be true and why did the equations work. They were told, shut up and calculate, use the equations, don't worry what they mean. And this is a little bit like, you know, if you learn about gravity and it's an inverse square law, you can calculate the orbit of the planets, you can calculate the trajectory to send a rocket to Mars, but then you ask, why is it an inverse square law? And Newton himself, who came up with the idea, didn't know. He famously said in Latin, but translated into English, I don't make hypotheses. I'm not offering an explanation. Well, it took a couple of hundred years for Albert Einstein to come along and come up with an explanation and curved space-time and black holes and all of that stuff. So the suspicion is that some future Einstein is going to come up with something and we'll then all smack ourselves on the forehead and say, oh, of course, that explains why these equations work. But as of now, we don't know why.
I just hope I'm around for that. Anyway, I think quantum mechanics starts with the double-slit experiment. What is the double-slit experiment and how does it illustrate wave-particle duality?
Now, this is the classic mystery. It sums it all up in a nutshell. We think about waves as being things like water waves, and you can see ripples on a pond, and if you drop two pebbles into a very still pond at the same time, you can see the ripples spreading out and literally interfering with one another, and they make what's called an interference pattern. And you could do the same thing with, among other things, with light. You shine a light through two small holes, and they may be slits or they may be little pinpricks in a screen, in a dark room or a laboratory, and the light spreads out and it makes a pattern of light and shade on another screen on the other side of the room or whatever it might be. And that proves, insofar as it means anything, that light is traveling as a wave. But you can do other experiments which prove that light travels like a particle, as photons. And crucially, the thing that really blows your mind, you can do the double slit experiment with electrons. And you can shoot electrons through a device called an electron gun. You use electricity rather than slits in screens, but you do the same job. You send an electron on a path through two screens and onto the other side where there's a detector, a bit like a TV screen, which makes a flash every time one of these electrons arrives. And if you shoot a beam of electrons through, they're particles leaving this gun, but on the other side, they make a pattern of light and shade on the screen, which proves they're waves. Worst of all, you can fire the electrons one at a time. You can leave a gap between them, you know, a long time, milliseconds, which is a long time in the quantum world. And you fire them through one at a time. Each one goes through the two slits somehow, one or the other slit, you might think, but maybe you're wrong. It arrives at the screen and makes one spot of light, one electron, one spot of light. You do this with 10,000 electrons, one after the other, and the pattern you get on the other side is the pattern for waves. Their particles are behaving like waves. They also know where the other particles are, and they're building up a pattern over time as if they were a load of things going through the screen all at once. It's very mysterious.
You know, you discuss early in your book three critical experiments in this area, and maybe you could discuss them now. There was one in the 1970s, one in the 1980s, and one about 5 years ago.
Well, the first people who did this, they did the basic experiment with a lot of electrons going through the screen and building up the pattern. And then the next people did an experiment where it was the one I've just described, where you fire the electrons one at a time and the pattern builds up. So the electrons seem to know what's happened in the past and the future, as well as what the electrons next door are doing. And then the last experiment is really, really subtle, and it's something which Richard Feynman, way back in the 60s, he discussed, as he discussed many things in quantum physics, and he dreamed up this beautiful experiment, which he said, nobody will ever be able to do this. It's too fantastic. And then somebody 50 years later did do it. And this involves having your screen on a very tiny scale, you know, a sub-microscopic scale. You've got two little holes, two slits, and you've got a slider which is moved by magnetic forces to and fro so you can open and close it. And basically what they do is, while the electrons are on the way, they open or close it. The computer opens or close it so that they know if there's one slit, it ought to behave like particles going through one hole. If there's two slits, it ought to behave like waves going through two holes. But how does it know which slit is open and which slit is closed? And they've done this with experiments moving these little tiny shutters to and fro on, you know, tiny fractions of a second while the electron's flying through space. So the electron doesn't know what's going on when it's not looking, if you like. And still you find if you've got two slits open, you get a wave pattern. If you've got one slit open, you get a particle pattern. Something very strange is going on here.
Astounding. What role does probability play in quantum theory?
Probability is both very important, and you can think of it as a kind of a red herring, because the classic interpretation, these ideas are all called interpretations because we don't really know what's going on. So we make up a story, and that's the interpretation. And the one that kicked our things off and started the ball rolling in the 1920s is called the Copenhagen interpretation, because a lot of the ideas came from Niels Bohr, who was a Danish physicist based in that city. But the probability came in from another guy, Max Born, not Bohr, who introduced this idea of probability. And this says that if you have something going on in the quantum world, anything at all, that you can't say with certain what's going to happen. You say that there's a certain probability, an exactly calculatable mathematical probability that it will do A or it will do B. And the simplest example of this is we've often heard about the idea of the half-life of a radioactive substance, that if you've got a pile of uranium or radium or whatever it might be, that half the atoms will decay, they'll change into something else in a certain time. So in that half-life, if you start with a pound of stuff, after one half-life, you've got half a pound left. And then in the next half-life, half of that half pound goes and you're left with a quarter, then an eighth, and so on. But you can never point at one atom and say, hey, this atom's going to go next, or this atom's going to not go for 10,000 years. You can never say. All you can say is there's a 50-50 probability that this particular atom will decay, will change in a certain time. And the probabilities apply to all these things. They apply to the supposed waves going through the double slits and so on. And you can say there's a probability that the electron's going to arrive at point A on the screen on the other side, and there's another probability that it will arrive at point B. But you can't point at any one electron before it sets off on its journey and say, oh, this one's going to go to A and this one's going to go to B. You just don't know. So it's all related to the idea that we hear about of uncertainty and not being able to make predictions in quantum physics, except in some kind of statistical sense.
What is superposition?
Well, this is related to probability too. You have a quantum thing. I mean, you don't like to use words like particle or wave, so thing or a quantum entity or whatever it might be. And again, take a very, very simple example. Electrons have a property that we call spin. Now, it's not like spin in the everyday sense, like the Earth spinning round, or if you put spin on a pool ball and make it whiz around the table. But you can think of it as kind of like something that points upwards or points downwards. And an electron that's made in a nuclear decay, the kind of thing I was talking about, sometimes an atom, the nucleus of an atom, will spit out an electron. And that electron will have, you think, a definite spin. But the theory says, and experiments seem to confirm, that it doesn't have the spin until you measure it. So it's in what's called the superposition. It's got this mixture of being pointing up and pointing down at the same time until something happens. It bumps into another particle, or you look at it with some, super microscope. And only at that point does it decide, oh, yeah, right, I'm pointing upwards and my other electron over here is pointing downwards. So it's not real in some sense until it's measured, or in the experiment with two holes, until it hits the screen on the other side.
What did Einstein call spooky action at a distance?
Right. Well, this is related to superposition. Now you actually have things. He talked about experiments involving photons and particles of light, but it's simpler to think in terms of electrons. And I should say, these experiments have now been done. I mean, much more complicated than simple description sounds like, but they've really been done. You can imagine a situation where an atom spits out two electrons in opposite directions. Okay, so you're balancing off momentum, all those things we learned about in school. Momentum and energy are all in balance. They're going in opposite directions. And the laws of quantum physics say that you've got two electrons, you've got to balance the laws of spin. So one must be up and one must be down. But hey, I just told you that it doesn't know. It's in a superposition. So you've got these two electrons flying off, miles away, maybe light years away, the other side of the universe, and they're each one in a superposition. As soon as somebody looks at one of them, measures them, it hits another atom, then it has to, for want of a better word, decide if it's spin up or spin down. The moment that electron is set in one way, the other electron miles away on the other side of the universe, wherever it is, at that moment, the other electron becomes the opposite. So electron A is spin up. So without anyone looking at it, anyone knowing about it, the other one becomes spin down. And that's what Einstein called spooky action at a distance. And he said, this is impossible. It's clearly nonsense. So quantum mechanics must be wrong. And then 30 years later, 40 years later, people came along and devised an experiment, a very, very subtle and clever experiment, which basically measured this. And it says, no, these things, even though they're separated from one another, they do have some kind of knowledge about each other. The spooky action at a distance really happens. And Einstein was very definitely wrong in this case, though perhaps fortunately he didn't live to hear and see about this.
I think when you talk about the electrons on the opposite sides of the universe and them knowing about each other, you're talking about entanglement. And when you're talking about what Einstein felt was probably that there must be a deeper explanation, is that hidden variables?
Well, this is one of the options. This whole package, you know, entanglement, spooky action at a distance, superposition. You can't separate them. They're all part of a package. And how you get into the story depends on which avenue you come into. And one of the three impossible ideas that I discuss is called hidden variables. And it says that there's something going on at a deeper level that we don't understand, and that the particles, entities, whatever you want to call them, but they really are in some sense set earlier in one being up and one being down because of these things that are called hidden variables, which affect what's going on. But there's a very peculiar thing about this. To make hidden variables work, you have to have another kind of wave, a field, as physicists call it, which fills the whole universe, and that is what tells the particles what to do. So instead of having something which is not sure if it's a wave or a particle, you've got a wave and you've got a particle, and the wave tells the particle what to do. And so it tells it that this one's got to be up and that one's got to be down. And so that's all fine and dandy. But the problem with this then is that the particles don't have any influence on the wave. And this sort of flies in the face of everything else we've ever learned about physics. Again, going back to Newton, you know, we all learned action and reaction are equal and opposite. If the wave affects the particle, surely the particle must affect the wave. So hidden variables sounds great. You know, you say there's some kind of clockwork going on and we don't know what the clockwork is, but then why don't the things we do affect the clockwork? You know, why doesn't it speed up, slow down? Why doesn't it stop ticking? You know, what's going on down there? So it's not as satisfactory as it seems at first sight.
What was John Bell's contribution to this?
Right, well, Bell's the guy who put the spooky action at a distance business into a set of equations, basically. I mean, Einstein and his colleagues talked about this in general terms, and they said, you know, it's common sense that these particles don't know about each other, and nobody will ever be able to test it. That was the thought they had in the 1930s, 40s, 50s. And then John Bell came along. He was a genius guy who worked at the particle physics laboratory at CERN in Geneva, and he was fascinated by all this stuff. And he'd been there a few years, and he'd earned a sabbatical. And so he got to go to the States and visit various places for a year and work on anything he wanted to do. He didn't have to work on particle accelerators. That was his day job. And so he buckled down and he looked at all this stuff, and he looked at Einstein's work and other work. And he actually devised a test to find out if the spooky action at a distance, the entanglement, really happens in the world we live in. And he worked out again, just as a kind of what they call a thought experiment, you know, imagining what could be done, that if it was possible to do certain things with particles of light, with photons, with some going in one direction and some in another. And again, using statistics, you'd have to count, in effect, count the number of electrons pointing up and the number of electrons pointing down in a run of, you know, hundreds of tests using atomic experiments. And he said that there's a number in here. And if number A is bigger than number B, then we know that Einstein was right and there's no entanglement, there's no spooky action at a distance. But if number B is bigger than number A, then we know that Einstein was wrong. But he didn't expect anyone to do this. And only 10 years later, in the 1970s, the first experiments were done which seemed to give an indication that Einstein was wrong. Number B was bigger than number A. And then over the 1980s, the experiments got refined until now it's absolutely rock solid fundamental part of science that what's called Bell's inequality is the right way up for Einstein to be wrong, if that doesn't sound too confusing to you. The universe really is built in with entanglement and spooky action at a distance. And the great thing about this, what's called Bell's test, the great thing about Bell's test is that it doesn't actually depend on quantum physics. Now, a lot of people don't understand this. They don't realize. They think it's a proof that quantum physics violates common sense. But what he's actually telling us is that the universe violates common sense. Even if it turned out, you know, God forbid, that quantum physics is completely wrong, the fact that we've done an experiment and the experiment has come out with Bell's inequality the way up it's come out, that proves that this is built into the universe, that things that are widely separated from one another do in some sense influence one another if they ever had an interaction in the past. And this is much deeper even than quantum physics. You know, it's getting into the realms of philosophy and you know, all that kind of stuff.
That's pretty impressive. There's a term that I've seen, quantum teleportation. What is it?
Right. Now, this is... it's kind of like teleportation, but it's not really physically taking a particle, let alone, you know, a human being, from one place and copying them somewhere else. What you can do, we scientists, not me, but people can do now as a matter of routine, is they can use a kind of a glorified Bell experiment. They can take all the information that's contained in a particle of light, a photon, and transfer it to another photon somewhere else. So the information about the first photon is destroyed in the process. So it's just as if you took the photon from place A to place B, though it's actually a different photon that's over there, but it's identical to the one you started out with. And this is something that's been built up dramatically in recent years. And even while I was writing my book, you know, the news was coming in of more developments. They started doing this across the lab, you know, 5 meters away. You could make a photon disappear here and an identical photon appear over there. Then they did it, and they did it actually in Switzerland. They used telephone wires in the Swiss telephone network to, as they call it, teleport a photon from one laboratory and to another laboratory on the other side of Geneva. And then they got to do it in the open air, and it's now been done between two islands in the Canary Islands, off the coast of Africa. They've actually done it across a distance of many kilometers. And then so far, the crowning achievement is Chinese scientists have done it from space. They've actually been able to teleport photons from a satellite in orbit down to a ground station on the ground. So they're taking all the information that's in a photon and they're putting it into photons on the ground. And this has got huge implications for communications, for the security of communications, because partly because you destroy the information that you started out with, it's a way of sending very secure messages, because anybody who tries to intercept it and read what's going on will scramble it all up. So they'll get no information. And then the people on the ground will know it's been scrambled up. So they'll know that someone's been trying to interfere. And so this is commercial potential. There's a lot of money going into it. And obviously, it's got military and political implications as well. So this is a huge, rapidly developing area today.
Absolutely fascinating. You know, you described probability theory a little earlier as one of the mathematical methods of describing quantum theory. I believe there are two. What's the other one? And is there any reason to prefer one or the other?
Well, the key difference, the one that is seen as a rival to the probability theory. I mean, I think probably you're referring to the many worlds or multiverse idea, and that instead of saying in the simplest possible case, an electron has got a choice of going through in the double slit experiment, it can go through slit A or it can go through slit B, and what happens afterwards depends on which one it goes through. You say that no, there are two universes, and in one universe it goes through slit A, and in another universe it goes through slit B. So you don't have to worry about probability, but instead, for every possible probability you have in every possible quantum event anywhere in the universe, you've got another universe. And that is what people have sometimes called the excess baggage interpretation, because they can't accept that you could have so many universes. But I don't know. I try very hard to be agnostic and not say which ones I think are good and which ones I think are bad, so that readers can choose for themselves. But, you know, is that really any crazier than the idea that, for instance, you know, the chair I'm sitting on is actually mostly empty space, and the atoms are empty space with electric forces holding them apart? You know, maybe 100 years' time, people will think this is common sense.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
One of the famous experiments that I've read about is the proposal by John Archibald Wheeler for the delayed choice experiment.
Yes.
What is it, and what conclusions can we reach from it?
This is extremely controversial. People argue about it immensely in the sort of quantum physics groups. But the point comes back to these little experiments that I talked about with the electrons going through tiny, tiny holes and when you open the shutters and close the shutters. And it's down to the particles, the electrons, the photons, whatever they are, deciding what they are, if you like, at the point you measure them. Now, you can imagine, and John Wheeler was imagining, but since then our telescopes have got so good that we can see it, light from a very, very distant object, you know, the things you may have heard of called quasars, far away on the other side of the universe, coming towards us from literally from billions of light years away, sometimes on its way to us, it passes very near to a cluster of galaxies, a really massive concentration of matter, which has a strong gravitational pull. And because of the strong gravitational pull, the light can be bent one way or the other around the cluster of galaxies. So it's kind of like a sort of cosmic double slit experiment, because there are two ways for the light to get to us. Now, the light coming to us, where if you could, needing something a little bit better than we've got yet, but, you know, in principle possible, if you could take the light coming from both sides, and we can see this, we can see two images of some of these quasars, if you could combine it and do the interference, like the waves interfering, you'd expect that you'd be able to make an interference pattern, and that would, in quotes, prove that light is a wave. But what Wheeler pointed out is that if you look at the light before it has a chance to make an interference pattern, you'll find it's a particle. You get the equivalent of a spot on a screen. But this light, you know, is either going to make an interference pattern, it's either going to be a wave, or it's not. It's going to be a particle. And yet it's come from billions of light years away, and the massive source in between that's being the gravitational lens, that might be a couple of billion light years away from us. And yet, at the very moment, you sitting in your lab, you know, with your finger over the buttons on your computer, say, oh, shall I make it a particle or shall I make it a wave? You go, bomb, you press the button, it becomes a wave, or it becomes a particle. What was it doing for 10 billion years on the journey? You know, does what you're doing now affect what happened back at the beginning of the universe? So it's called the delayed choice experiment. It's never been done. It's the delayed choice mystery, if you like. It's probably a better word. But according to what we know about quantum physics, what happens to that light particle or wave will depend on the measurement we choose to make now, even though it's been traveling all that time and all that distance to get to us.
I should tell listeners that John's book has the various different interpretations of quantum mechanics. And I don't think we're going to get to all of them in this interview because that. But here's what you can do. You can read the book. It's a lot of fun. One of the interpretations is de Broglie's pilot wave explanation of duality. Can you tell us a little about that?
Well, this is really the it's both the improved version of the underlying reality idea that I mentioned earlier, that there is some clockwork and waves and particles both exist, and it's also the original idea. And it's an interesting story because it shows how physicists are influenced by fashion and by prestige, you know, just like people in other fields of life are. De Broglie was one of the clever guys who came up with the basic ideas of quantum physics in the 1920s. And he started out from Einstein's work, which had showed that light is not just a wave, it's a particle as well, or either or, depending on what you choose to measure. And he said, well, if what we used to think was a wave can actually be a particle, maybe what we used to think was a particle, electrons, can also be a wave. And then he did more than just think about it. In those terms, he did the calculations and worked out the equations and all the rest of it. And he was the man who proved that electrons can be both wave and particle. And that then led to a whole load of experiments and things which helped to develop quantum mechanics. And he was puzzled, like everybody else, about how this could be. And so he was the first person who actually said there could be both a particle and a wave. And he presented this at a major scientific meeting at the end of the 1920s. And also at that meeting was this guy, Niels Bohr, that I mentioned. And that was the meeting where he presented his Copenhagen interpretation, saying that it's all probabilities and nothing decides what it is until you measure it. And he was the big man in science, you know, at that time. He was a top dog and he was very forceful. And de Broglie was pretty good, but, you know, he wasn't the same kind of aggressively famous top dog that Niels Bohr was. He was a bit more diffident. He presented his ideas. He didn't like go out to bat for them. He just said, well, this is a good idea. What do you guys think? And everybody was overwhelmed by Bohr. And so they said, no, it's rubbish. Bohr's right. And then years later, other people came along and developed the same kind of idea. And then they had a look at what had been published in scientific journals and so on. And they said, oh, no, de Broglie said this, you know, back in the 1920s. Maybe he wasn't so crazy after all. So, you know, fashions come and fashions go. The Copenhagen interpretation, which, without giving too much away, I think is probably the worst of all the six ideas that I discuss in the book. That is still taught at a basic level. If you're starting out at, you know, university, then you're probably going to get taught quantum physics that way. And then later on, you'll find, oh, no, there are several other ways of looking at it. Maybe it's not right after all. And it's a great pity that this still holds sway, because it's a very feeble way of trying to explain things.
You know, I think one of the things that outsiders to the science world don't seem to realize is that personalities do play a role in it. Certain ideas do dominate for periods of time as a result that because they have the people who are the strongest proponents on their side, like in this instance. And the fortunate thing is that at least science gets the opportunity to get it right by doing experiments.
That's absolutely crucial. Yeah, I mean, it's this is why this particular area keeps sort of bubbling along so long, because all the experiments do is they tell us that the quantum physics is right, but they don't tell us why it's right, as we said at the beginning of this discussion. And so that there's a lot of scope for fashions to come and go. But I, in a similar way, something I used to work in cosmology many years ago, and that there was a big debate in those days about the Big Bang idea and the steady state theory, you know, and people would sort of go at each other hammer and tongs and say, I'm right and you're wrong, and say, no, you're wrong and I'm right. And as you say, the beauty is we are then able to do experiments, or the equivalent of experiments, make observations, put up satellites, measure the radiation from the Big Bang and say, well, you know, whether you love the steady state theory or not, you're out of luck, because we can tell you that the Big Bang theory is a better version. I always hesitate to say right, you know, say one idea is better than another one. Maybe a better one still is going to come along one day, like Einstein with the general theory of relativity being better than Newton's theory of gravity. You know, Newton's not wrong, but this is a better theory. And the fascinating thing for me is that it's actually very hard to sort of point your finger at any of these quantum ideas and say, well, this one is the best, you know, let alone the right one. You can say, well, you know, I like this one. And then another day you might look and say, well, I quite like this one as well. So there's a lot of uncertainty, a lot of debate, and it makes life very exciting.
What is Mach's principle?
Well, this is... sort of brings in cosmology and quantum physics. Excuse me.
That's quite okay.
It's related to this idea of spooky action at a distance and entanglement and so on, because what quantum physics is telling us is that things that are widely separated have an influence on each other. Now, this is something that puzzled people back in Newton's day, that not in terms of particles and quantum physics, but in terms of a big lumps of matter that we can see and the universe out there. Now, you know, we all know about inertia. You know, if you push something, it doesn't want to be pushed, quite apart from friction. You know, if you're in space and you're an astronaut, you've got to push something to make it move, and then it keeps moving until it gets another knock. Well, this is what it's moving relative to is the whole universe. If you measure, what do you have to move something relative to in order to feel inertia? It's everything in the universe. What Newton would have regarded as the average of all the stars in the universe, and now we think of the average of all the galaxies in the universe. And he showed in an experiment that you can actually do for yourself, that this is something that is to do with what's going on out in the world at large, with a bucket of water. It's as simple as that. If you have a bucket of water and you hang it from a rope and you twist the bucket up round the rope and then let go, the bucket starts spinning, but at first the water doesn't start spinning and it stays flat, but then it picks up through friction. It picks up the rotation of the bucket, and as it moves, the water then develops this dip in the middle. The flat surface gets curved, and then you grab the bucket to stop it moving. The bucket stops, but the water's still moving, and it carries on moving and having this dip in the surface, and as it slows down, the surface gets flat again. So the water in the bucket doesn't care whether it's moving relative to the bucket or relative to the walls of your room or whatever it is. It cares how it's moving relative to the whole universe. So something out there, presumably gravity, you know, is influencing what's happening down here. And this is a quite separate indication that everything, I mean, it sounds a bit sort of hippy-dippy stuff, but, you know, everything is connected to everything else, that what we're doing, how we move, how the Earth moves is related to the distribution of all the matter in the universe, to put it in physicist language. And then the quantum physicists come along and they say the behavior of electrons is related to, in a sense, the distribution of the other electrons in the universe. So there's a more than a hint here of something deep and curious and interesting going on. And that might very well be the direction we need to go in to get the underlying thing that we don't yet understand.
You talked earlier about the many worlds interpretation, which I've always liked, simply because when my favorite sports team loses a very close contest, I can always say, okay, in some other universe it won.
Exactly.
But anyway, what has been the history of how the physics community has viewed the many worlds interpretation?
It's very curious, because people who have heard of this probably know the name of Hugh Everett, who got the idea quite independently of anyone else in the 1950s, and he worked on a version of it for his PhD thesis, and it was published. But he went off. He was very interested in complicated mathematical stuff, which is disarmingly called games theory, which is actually the theory of warfare, you know, and working out how to deal with, in those days, nuclear threats and perceived nuclear threats. And he went off to work on classified stuff, and he's kind of disappeared from the science community because of his other interests. And so the idea wasn't taken up very much for quite a long time. And what he didn't know was that actually Erwin Schrödinger, who's one of the pioneers of quantum physics and famous for his cat in a box paradox story, that he'd also come up with a version of this idea that you never have this collapse of a quantum system into a state according to probabilities, that all the states exist at the same time. And it was not until much later that people became interested, and the idea became promoted, particularly in the context of quantum computing, because the something's a very, very hot topic now, you know, and something that I followed as a very esoteric branch of quantum physics 20, 30 years ago. If you can use this superposition of states, this superposition of particles, you can make very powerful computers. And we're just starting to hear stories about this. There are rumors about what IBM's doing and what Google's doing and all kinds of stuff like this. But the nub of it is that if you've got a quantum system that is in a state where an electron which can point up or down, you can think of that as your switch, your on-off, your binary yes, no, one, zero. But in a quantum computer, because of superposition, it can, in a sense, it can be both at once. And that means that you can have many, many more bits of information per particle, for want of a better term, and it goes as the 2^2, however many you've got. So if you have 3 switches, okay, in a very simple bit of a computer, and they're ordinary on-off switches, then you've got a limited number of positions. But if you've got 3 quantum switches, they're called qubits from the bits and quantum, then you have 2^3 switches. So you've got the equivalent of 8 switches, and obviously powers run away very quickly. Once you get, you know, 2^10 is over 1,000. So where you would have 10 bits in a conventional computer, you've got 1,000 bits in a quantum computer, which is obviously a lot more powerful, and they can do other tricks as well. So people then were saying, well, how can they do this? And one school of thought is that there is a multiplicity of worlds, many worlds, and that what you've actually got is a lot of different quantum computers, you know, in a lot of different worlds, and they're all working on the same problem, because the physicists in the different worlds are all copies of you and me and whatever, and so they're all interested in the same problem, so they're all working on the same problem, and all these computers in the many worlds are churning out the answers that you can't get, at least not so quickly, with conventional computers. So many worlds has gone from being, you know, crazy idea to being, well, it's a bit crazy, but it might be true, to, hey, this actually might be important in the real world. So again, it's not proven, but it's interesting. And it's especially interesting because there is a possibility. There's a guy called David Deutsch in Oxford who works on this area. He's pioneered it. And he thinks that if we developed a proper quantum computer, one that was versatile enough, that we could program it in such a way that it would be aware of the other worlds while it was computing a problem in the way I described. And it wouldn't be able to say what was going on, but it would, you know, kind of feel its brain, you know, splitting into different parts and then coming back together. So you could ask it, do the many worlds exist? And it would be able to say yes or no, but Deutsch hopes it would say yes.
Wow. Just incredible. One of the things that I enjoyed about your book was the way you explained the difference between coherence, decoherence and incoherence in the context of waves.
I can't resist sort of playing with language. I enjoy those little things. And there's a theory, an interpretation, which is called coherence. And because things obviously are working together, are coherent. And there's a nice example of this. If you're in a sports stadium, quite often you see people doing the Mexican wave, where people raise their hands and lower them in turn as they go around, and that sends a coherent wave going round the stadium. And if everybody just waves their hands about at random, you know, then they're doing just as much waving and there's just as much energy, but it's incoherent. And decoherence is when you go from one state to the other state. And what the people who support this idea and like this interpretation, what they say is that in quantum physics, what's happening is that for a pure particle, like a single atom or a single electron, that behaves purely like a quantum thing, a quantum entity, and it obeys all these funny rules and Bell's test and all that stuff. But if you have a lot of them together, that the information gets jumbled up in the same sort of way. So it decoheres. And slightly tongue-in-cheek, I say they should actually call their interpretation the incoherent interpretation, because they start with coherence and the real world then is incoherent. And that's why you don't, you know, in Schrodinger's famous thought experiment, you don't see cats that are half dead and half alive. Cats are made of lots of atoms, you know, and those atoms interfere with one another. And famously, one of Einstein's objections to the Copenhagen interpretation, that things only become real according to probabilities when you measure them or look at them. And he said, well, are you telling me the moon doesn't exist when I'm not looking at it? You know, and the answer from the coherence people, the incoherence people, as I call them, is that the moon exists because all the atoms in the moon are interacting with each other and jumbling up the quantum information, if you like to think of it that way. And it kind of makes sense.
I like to think of it as the moon exists because the universe is looking at it.
That's one way.
Yeah. Anyway, you discussed the Schrodinger cat experiment. Tony Leggett did some experiments, and what were they, and what did they show?
Oh, yeah. Well, Leggett. This is something where I've actually met the people and seen the apparatus that involved in this. It relates to this coherence business, because he was interested in scaling up what goes on to the size of something you could feel and touch and hold. And he worked with rings of metal that were cooled to very low temperatures where they become superconducting. And you can put an electric current into them and they go round, you'd imagine they go round the ring one way, and that's fine. But because they're superconductors and they're very cold, and then they can be made to behave like quantum rings. And in a quantum ring, you can make the wave go both ways at once. It's not two different waves going round, two different electric currents. It's the single electric current going both ways at once round the ring. And this is the strongest evidence against this decoherence idea, because these things he had at the time he worked at Sussex, where I've got some contacts. He was working with things about the size of a wedding ring, and I've actually held one of them in my hand, although obviously not when it was cooled to -270 degrees. This thing, under the right conditions, behaves like a single quantum entity. It does these things that we've been talking about. So it's not just, you know, electrons and invisible things and photons and all that. It can actually be scaled up to something of an everyday kind of size. And again, this has huge implications. The practical side of his work is it's used in MRI scanners. You know, if anyone listening has ever been in hospital and been in one of those scanners, they're using this. That this is the magnetic resonance that they're using is based on this principle. So it's enormously important for practical reasons. And Leggett got he got a Nobel Prize and a knighthood, being British. I can't remember in which order, but you know, I don't know which ones. I suppose the knighthood's more prestigious, and the Nobel Prize has got more money.
Yeah, I go for the money. You know, one of the things that people don't realize is how impactful all this stuff is on their everyday life. Because you mentioned MRI scanners. We take MRI scanners just for granted. I'm going to have one in another app. But nonetheless, these things would not exist had physicists not thought about quantum mechanics, developed the theory, come up with ideas, and then saw applications to the real world.
Absolutely. I mean, the things I talk about when I'm talking about electrons being fired from guns and going off and hitting screens and so on, I mean, that is essentially the technology of old-style TV tubes and semiconductors. You know, when the chip in your smartphone, that's all quantum physics. And then not purely quantum physics at the moment, but you know, one of the things that always amazes me is when you have GPS and you're using satellites to work out your position on the ground, and you want to say, oh, where's the nearest pizza restaurant, and it tells you, those satellites have to use both of Einstein's great theories. They have to use the general theory of relativity because they're moving in the Earth's gravity, and they have to use the special theory of relativity because they're moving very fast. And if they didn't make allowance for both those theories, they wouldn't be able to tell you where the nearest pizza restaurant is. And quantum physics, you know, comes in to hugely into anything to do with computing. Anywhere where you hear the word chip, you know, the chip is working on quantum principles. It's just completely runs our lives these days.
I think we have time for one more possible interpretation before I ask you what you're planning on doing next, which is how I usually end these interviews. Okay. So what is the consistent histories interpretation?
Consistent histories is kind of, it says that we don't know what ever happened, okay? We can only know where we are now. And this is, it sounds like philosophy, but what you say is that there are, instead of saying there are many worlds which could exist, you say there are many ways in which we might have got to the state we're in today, okay? So if you look at the fossils and you say, oh, look, there are these fossils, and these fossils are consistent with the idea that there were these big creatures called dinosaurs around, you know, 100 million years ago or whatever it might be. But you can't actually say that there were dinosaurs around, okay? It's a bit more than that in terms of philosophy, a bit more than that. Rather than what the philosophers might say, you can actually put equations into it. And this is what Stephen Hawking did in one of his major pieces of work, which the public doesn't really know much about. He tried to explain the Big Bang that we were talking about, the beginning of the universe, in terms of consistent histories. And instead of starting out by saying, I'm a physicist, I know what the equations of physics are, let's start with a Big Bang and calculate how we get to be where we are today. Well, if you do that, you find masses of possibilities, you know, many worlds in another kind of sense, different things that could happen to a Big Bang. Why would it come out to be like ours? But if you start with where you are today and kind of work backwards, being consistent, then you get back to something and you can say, oh, this must be how the universe began in order for the consistent path to be followed to lead to us. I hope that makes some kind of sense. So it's a way of looking at the world which is based on the fact that we're here now and what we can see around us, but is not starting from the bottom up. It's starting from the top down, if you like.
John, I just want to say that I've enjoyed this interview almost as much as I enjoyed reading your book. And that's saying a lot.
Thank you very much.
I'm sure that you have other plans in the future. What I always do is I conclude the interview by, first of all, asking how the listeners can get in touch with you.
Well, I'm on Facebook. That's probably the easiest way. I'm just on there as me. And I've got a blog which is almost dormant called John Gribbin Books, which you could find with a search. I'm always interested in people giving me feedback and telling me what's going on with their lives.
Yeah, one of the things that I've always found about people who are related to academics is that they're much more interested in contacting people and answering their questions than, say, politicians.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of academics, being one myself. And finally, what other projects do you have on the horizon that the listeners might be interested in?
Well, I've got one. I do a lot of work with my wife, and we've got a book coming out which is completely different. But next spring is a book about it's the history of the idea of evolution, which is, it's not quite as dull as it sounds, but it goes back to the ancient Greeks and obviously up through Darwin in the 19th century, and then what's happened in the 20th century. That's a much bigger book. And then because Six Impossible Things has been fairly well received, you know, as this discussion testifies, our publishers are keen for me to do another short book, but I'm not allowed to talk about it yet, but there will be another short book in a year or so.
Well, John, I certainly hope if it's anything related to math or physics that you send me a copy so I can
absolutely
read it.
Okay, will do. No problem.
Terrific. John, take care.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Sure. Bye.